take a network break. Enjoy a back-to-school virtual donut and join us for our weekly analysis of the tech news worth talking about. Today's show is sponsored in part by IT Pro TV. You can upgrade your career and learn the skills you need to acquire the most in-demand certifications with their engaging online training courses. Just visit itpro.tv/network and use the code NETWORKBREAK, all one word, and that means you can try it free for 7 days and get 30% off your monthly membership for the lifetime of your active subscription. And stay tuned after the news. We've got a coffee talk with 128 Technology. We're going to discuss session-based routing and how it can optimize network performance to deliver critical business services. All right, to the news. Severe weather and lightning strikes apparently caused a Microsoft Azure data center in San Antonio, Texas, to shut down temporarily last week, affecting customer access to services, including the mighty Office 365.
I think the real problem here was that this data center was key to their Active Directory, which meant that a lot of people just weren't able to access any Azure services, as I understand it. So it's not just, if you count the number of data centers that went down, didn't really matter. They had plenty more. Like Azure, as I remember, it has tens of data centers.
Yes.
Or maybe hundreds. But this one actually has impacted most of the Active Directory in multiple regions. And so people couldn't access anything. So Microsoft up to their old tricks, did really, you know, second-rate products, crappy services and finding out bugs, you know, ship it, what the hell, customers can suck it up.
Finding out the hard way.
Finding out the hard way. It's like Microsoft Office, right? We'll ship it. It's got lots of features. It'll do all the things. Oh, well, you know, well, we'll fix it. We'll fix it for you. That's okay. So it's not like it's a problem because we've, you know, now that we've found a bug, we can go and fix it. So don't worry, Mr. Customer. Yes, we know you paid us loads of money, loads of truckloads of money. And yes, we produce rubbish products, but hey, suck it up. You bought it.
Or you know, are renting it, at least in this case.
Yeah, you know, it's one of these things. Admittedly, a lightning strike is, they claim in the root cause saying a lightning strike nearby took out the power fluctuations, right?
Yeah, it made a temperature spike, and so the system automatically went into a controlled shutdown, yeah.
Okay, so you might want to say that Zeus reached down from the Marvel heaven and decided that Microsoft had offended him, which, you know, rightly so, to be fair. But the point is that they should have designed their data center to do this. I think Microsoft is absolutely at fault here. They should be resistant to lightning strikes.
Well, it sounds like it was a lightning strike somewhere else that may have caused a power surge that caused the overheating. So it was a sort of cascade of events. But if the fact is they had essentially this one data center was sort of the root for all their Active Directory infrastructure that was going to affect other people, that sounds like a bad design issue.
So the Active Directory is the problem. And the second problem is that they've completely failed to design their data centers correctly. If a lightning strike in the general area can take down their data center, that's not a very good data center. They should be earthed. They should be able to handle that. That's pretty basic data center design. I know I've sat through meetings with, you know, lightning strikes and, well, terrorist attacks and things like that. And this is the sort of thing that's in the process that to ensure that the data centers, that power systems can cope with that. Now, okay, sure, if the weather event took out the local grid, still, their data center should be resistant to that. Their cooling system should not go down because of a voltage fluctuation.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like those data centers are 20 years old and running, you know, infrastructure that's built years ago. These are all fancy new stuff.
They should be, yes.
Yeah, I would say that Microsoft needs to cop this on the chin, and everybody should be blaming them for poor physical design of their data centers, poor placement. If they're going to put them in a place where severe weather happens, then this is bad. And then finally, and probably the most heinous, is the whole global, like a significant percentage of the global Active Directory came out of this region. That is like pretty grim. If you're in Azure, you should be really considering whether you should be exiting at this point, because that's a demonstrative, that's like an Equifax style problem.
Oof, that's harsh words.
Yeah, I mean, it's there. Like if these basic functionality, these basic issues exist, then you're going to see a lot more of them. I'll bet we see more and more of this in the future.
Well, certainly talking about severe weather in the United States, it doesn't really matter where you go. Severe weather is going to be an issue. So data center design has to account for that. Absolutely.
It does. But also you could also locate your data centers in places where severe weather doesn't happen. A lot of the time these data centers are located in places where power is cheap or labor is cheap or where the government, the local government gives them access to kickbacks, tax-free holidays or, you know, bonuses to locate it in the region in the theory that it'll create jobs, which they don't. But that's not, you know. And so they locate them in places where severe weather occurs just for that reason. It's a straight up business decision. No, you know, customers don't really matter in this because you can make promises to get around it. And I think Microsoft's been caught out here.
It sounds like it. We've got a link to a story in Data Center Dynamics that kind of runs through the day by day, blow by blow, and as well as a link to Microsoft's status update page if you want to look at the gory details.
Yeah, this to me looks like some fundamental flaws. They've got problems with their design. their whole process. And I think you'll probably start to see more and more problems come out of this, because these are things they should absolutely have designed for by now.
Well, the one thing I can guarantee you is that we will see more severe weather events everywhere. So
yeah, global warming,
that's
hello.
Not going away.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And if your power systems can't cope with a bit of a surge every now and then, you've got serious problems. You can't fix that with a software update.
That's right. That's a big problem.
Yeah.
All right, moving on. Greg, I know how much you love BGP, and we all know that BGP route hijacking is a problem. Now, the U.S. agency NIST, that's the National Institute for Science and Technology, has released a draft specification for route origin validation that's using cryptographic techniques to validate route announcements. And this draft is based on Resource Public Key Infrastructure, or RPKI. And NIST has a proof of concept, so they're demonstrating actually how to deploy this. They're offering guidance on deployment and sharing best practices, and they've partnered with folks like AT&T, Cisco, Juniper, and Comcast to roll this out.
So I've got mixed feelings about this. I mean, who is NIST in terms of global capabilities to stand up and talk about this? Now, and what I mean by that is, sure, the NIST is a government body. It's part of the U.S. Department of Commerce. They're releasing a sort of a paper here to say, can we protect the route I origin? Okay, great. So an arm of the U.S. government has published a paper coming out in support of RPKI. But we also have BGPSec. Now, whether we should be using RPKI or BGPSec is not really something that a department of the U.S. government should be talking about. In my opinion, it should be a global consortium of people, because we have to have the whole world to agree on this. Fair?
It's a tricky issue. I know NIST has been deeply involved with cryptography in the United States and ensuring cryptographic standards and doing testing and stuff. So I think they have some validity here when it comes to working with the internet community. I definitely, with something like BGP that's used globally, there should be a global effort to secure it. But somebody's got to start somewhere.
Well, and in reading through the collaboration here, they're talking about the build involvement on Cisco. Get this. A 7206 VXR, that's a 15-year-old router. An ISR 4331, that's a 5 to 10-year-old router. A 2921, that's a 10 to 15-year-old router. And an iOS XRV, that's a virtual ASR. They've also tested on an MX80 from Juniper. While you would think this is going to be something serious, that's amateur hour, using really, really old 5 to 15-year-old technology. That's not exactly filling me with confidence that this is a serious industry announcement.
Well, I don't know. If you sort of flip that on its head, maybe they're trying to say, we know that there's a lot of legacy equipment out there in service provider and telco networks, and so we're working from that assumption that we're going to be working with old technology and trying to make it work regardless of the environment. So maybe that's a good thing?
Yep. Maybe, but I mean, you know, BGPSec has several advantages over RPKI. BGPSec obviously validates the source, but also validates the path that the route went along. So the thing is that whereas you propagate the BGP announcement, it has to be signed by each router in the path so that you know that the path that you receive is the path that was that it traversed or was advertised, right? And the receiver that receives it is also then validated. So sender, receiver, there's a security validation, and then every step in the path is validated. So whereas RPKI just says, this person who announced the route did announce that route. So it doesn't actually protect the integrity of the internet routing table. It still allows intermediate hops to break down. However, RPKI is much easier to deploy because only the speaker, only the sender needs to set this up. And you can talk to so if your neighbors aren't, you know, speaking BGPSec, you're dead. That the whole process sort of falls down. The brutal reality is what we need is BGPSec. The best we can manage is RPKI. And that's why we've never seen BGP, any form of, you know, integrity or path validation in BGP succeed, because we can't change anything. And the problem with a microservices architecture, like we got it in the network or a federated system, if you want to call it that, is everybody's got a want to change. And as far as the internet's concerned, the people that matter have very limited motivation to change. And in fact, there is a substantial disincentive because they have to go and update their routers, if indeed they can be. And they may have to go back to vendors and buy new memory, buy new software, buy new blah, blah. And a lot of them don't even have the competency to do this. So I'm not sure, you know, nice to see people putting an effort in. IPv6 would actually be more helpful right about now, I suspect. And I'm not sure that NIST is a body that has credibility here. Nice document, though.
Well, that's something.
Like, it's a bit, you know, the NIST is a standards body, but it's not the standards body associated with this protocol. BGP is part of the ITF initiative, if that makes sense. And the ITF has bodies and so forth to talk about this. They've done interoperability testing. I don't understand why they're doing this. So
I guess I would say my impression is just a total guess is that because NIST has done work in cryptography in the past that they feel like working with public keys, they may have some credibility here. It also seems like this is one of those efforts where instead of waiting for everyone to come up to perfection, let's try to get some kind of security or authentication mechanism in place somewhere. I feel like we went through this maybe 10 years ago around spam prevention, when there was a lot of effort around getting folks to identify and validate their email domains.
Yeah, there's some useful stuff in here. If I was doing a testing, I would take their testing plan.
Yeah.
So if I was doing a deployment around this, maybe if I needed to write some automation around RPKI, this would be very useful because I could look at some of these things and derive a testing suite. But really what we need is a testing suite, not a piece of paper with some testing stuff on it.
Right. Well, you know, it is a draft for public comment. I guess they're looking to get some input maybe before they put some actual code behind it, which I should mention, by the way, if you're interested in looking at this draft, we have links, and their public comment section on this proposal is open until October 15th, 2018. So if you want to go check it out and weigh in.
Sure. And I mean, this initiative goes right the way back to May 2017. I note on their website, they've been calling for comments. So it's been a long and winding process to get this far. So, you know, just wait and see, I guess.
Yeah. And back to my spam thing with domain credentials and so on, that took a lot of effort. It took a lot of coordination. It took a lot of time. And frankly, it was just, I think some big folks, I remember Yahoo was very involved saying, look, we're just going to start doing this and hopefully others will follow along. So that may be the idea here too. We just got to try to get the ball rolling and start something.
Well, remember we talked about a few weeks back, there was all of the telcos in the ISP and IXPs in Europe agreed to take out a particular AS. Because he was a known spammer.
Right,
and everybody eventually disconnected him from their BGP peering.
Yeah.
And he was taken off the internet. Well, that might be enough. You know, if we can solve 80% of the network's problems by just coming to a common agreement around known spammers, because today, you know, everybody just keeps carrying that traffic because everybody's too lazy to take the time. If there was just a consensus, you know, an open consensus that these are the worst actors and we should disconnect them, you know, or DPF from them, then they wouldn't be in business. And we could take 80% of the spam off because 80% of it comes from just a handful of players.
Right. And I guess that's part of my larger point is that let's start somewhere. And maybe that's what NIST is thinking. Let's start somewhere.
I mean, yeah. Well, you know, RPKI has been around for a very long time, like IPv6.
Well, look how long that's taken. So
exactly. So, which begs the question, you know, IPv6 is inevitable because at this point, there's no way we can go around for an IPv7, IPv8 type thing. It's just, you know, there's enough momentum behind it. But the flip side of this is maybe RPKI or BGPSEC, maybe neither of them is the answer. And it's not too late to open up the race.
Yeah, that could be.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we'll leave that there for now. We've chewed on that quite a bit. Let's move on. We got some news about eBay. The e-commerce giant last week posted a blog announcing that it is building its own servers and it's going to make that server design public.
So good for eBay, I guess. I always thought that once you get to a certain size, building your own servers makes sense, as we've seen many of the cloud companies prove, and also many of the mid-size clouds are starting to do the same thing. I was always under the impression that Dell has been a big supplier to eBay, and when I toured around Dell, they did sort of suggest to us that eBay was one of their biggest customers, so Dell won't be too happy.
No, I'm sure.
Unless Dell is actually doing the manufacturing on these for them. Now, it is possible that Dell has a custom manufacturing arm and eBay may actually be, you know, designing these to some level, but Dell may actually be doing the rest. That's entirely possible.
Yeah, I think so. Whether it's Dell or not, but I'm sure they're contracting with someone to do the actual manufacture of all the components.
Yeah, they won't be doing the detailed. Well, maybe they are doing the detail. We saw Facebook do the detailed physical design on their box and their boards, but there's plenty of companies they can subcontract to do the design for them, you know, pull a template off the show. Building an x86 server is certainly beyond most enterprises. But, you know, at the end of the day, you can go to companies who are well known in that space. If you're in the space of building silicon and getting manufacturing done, they can pull an x86 template effectively out of their library and say, well, how would you like it customized? Do you know what I mean?
Yep.
And it's not like it's massive amounts of work to adapt it to eBay's requirements.
Sure.
I thought LinkedIn did more with their Open19 standard, but never got legs. Facebook did the same with its Open Compute, which hasn't really got legs. They tried a different rack format for a while, which I don't know how many people got behind, which leads into the discussion around, do you think open sourcing will matter?
For the majority of people who listen to this show, probably not. You know, I thought this blog post seemed more almost like a recruitment pitch, because they don't actually give a lot of detail about the server design. They don't say how they're going to open source it, whether it's going to be Open Compute or some other body. It's mostly about how we have a great culture. Our culture is innovative. We love our culture, which made me think, this seem more like pitching it toward people like as a recruitment effort more than anything?
That sounds more like an internal process. Even though we published it on our blog, it's to try and tell people internally we're doing something useful.
That could also be, yes, yes.
Just typical corporate politics.
Yeah.
No, I suspect that there's not, you know, as I just said, Open Compute, Open 19, you know, there's a whole raft of these open standards around these server hardware. Is there room for another one and does it add something? Is there magic in what eBay's doing? Enterprises are showing unabashed love for these highly customized servers that like Cisco UCS or HP's or the Dell R-Series or, you know, even Blade servers are still incredibly popular. This, you know, it's like enterprise can't shake loose from the custom silicon idea of buying mini computers from 20 years ago. We've got to buy it. We've got to buy the blessed. And these vendors are stuffing in all the customized features they can, especially in the, around the ILO and the NIC cards. Their big thing at the moment is to put in fancy NICs with advanced processors and then treat them like they're mystical magic. You can just go buy a NIC from anybody else. It's the same thing, you know. So I'm a bit sort of, you know, ambivalent about this. I don't know that open sourcing it matters because open sourcing of other things never got any traction and any movement. So maybe what would make this one different? So I'm a bit on the cynical side for this one.
Well, the design is supposed to come out fourth quarter 2018, so we'll see if it bubbles up to the surface at the end of the year.
Yeah, don't tell me what you're going to do. Just tell me what you've done.
Right.
I'm really tired of this. We're going to open source it as if that's important. That's a sign of we've got internal problems and we might be saying we're going to open source it so that we can actually open source it because that's good for our resumes.
Right.
This doesn't sound like an initiative that's going to get legs.
We'll see. All right, quick break to tell you about today's sponsor, IT Pro TV. Whether you're just starting out or you're a seasoned IT professional, IT Pro TV is the only source you'll need. You can learn skills to pass the most in-demand IT certs from entry-level to advanced, and they've got engaging hosts and a talk show-style format, and they call it binge-worthy learning. So don't just binge on Netflix, you can also binge on some education. Their extensive course library includes CEH V9, CISA, CompTIA, Mac Certified Support Professional, and many more. And you want to weigh in, Greg?
Yeah, for sure. There's no need to leave home. Stream the courses wherever you are. You can do that at work, obviously, on a web interface, or maybe you can do it on a mobile phone in the crapper, if that's your particular thing. For those of you who have a fancy study at home and you've got a TV on the wall, you can also stream them up there. So if you visit itprotv.com/network, use the code NETWORKBREAK to try it free for 7 days and then receive 30% off your monthly membership for a lifetime of your app subscription. See? That's a pretty good way. Now, premium subscriptions include Kaplan practice exams and virtual labs, which is pretty good for the entry-level exams, pretty useful in terms of getting you in the habit of sitting through the exam process and doing questions and answers in the format of the test that we all do. Now, that's normally $857 a year, but when you use code NETWORKBREAK, you'll only pay $600 a year. Now, standard subscriptions and corporate memberships are also available. I would strongly advise you to get the boss to pay for it because that's a really good thing.
Yeah.
Usually the boss can do this fairly straightforward. Get a corporate subscription, put it forward and say, you know, do training for all the family, the team, family, partnership, whatever. So visit itpro.tv/network. Don't forget to use the code NETWORKBREAK and we thank them for sponsoring the podcast.
All right, we're moving into the wireless section of today's news analysis. Meraki, they've announced new wireless APs, including the MX67C and the MX68CW, both of which include built-in LTE modems.
I can't believe that Meraki was actually recommending to people to put a USB port and then put a 3G modem on the back. That's just naff.
Is that what they were doing before?
Yeah, that's what they were doing. You had a dongle and you plugged it into the USB and called it SD-WAN. And the problem with that is the dongles tend to let me assure you that in the real world, those dongles work their way loose or they go into some dodgy environment. Like those USB connectors are not very well sealed and the 3G modems come unplugged or people just steal them because like, ooh, 3G modem stick. I'll have one of those. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Slip that in the pocket.
Yeah. So they're sort of like a nasty hack. They're physically quite unreliable. Gravity and vibration can work the dongles loose or break them or people just steal them. So now Meraki has put the SG, you put the SIM card inside and there's a little flip door on it. So it makes sort of makes the MX series for Meraki look like a proper grown-up product. As always, Meraki is a very simple networking product. It lacks many capabilities, which is both a strength and a weakness. The other thing I noticed about as I was sort of getting up to speed on this is that Meraki's SD-WAN path detection is super, super simple. It's basically, they just got some Java. They're using Google's protobufs, and they're using the standard Java library and then calling that SD-WAN. That's like, not so much. That's just like we've got Java. How can we do SD-WAN just using Java code? Because that's what Meraki runs on, I would think. So, ooh, nasty.
Yikes.
But I bet it works.
Well,
sort of.
they do a good job of simplification, easy to roll out, easy to use. So maybe that's all folks want.
Yeah, but technically, yeah, not as sophisticated as some of the other SD-WAN solutions. It would work for simple, small business stuff. If you're growing up a bit and you need faster failover, I'm fairly sure that their path detection capabilities would struggle.
Do you feel like SD-WAN or more like hybrid WAN?
I think Meraki's sort of hooked onto sort of like the basic features of SD-WAN, like path sharing and path monitoring, and that's about it.
Okay.
You know, and maybe they'll add into more features, but everything else will be up in the Viptela gear, and Cisco will want, you know, strategically to upsell you. Yeah, and that's fine. I mean, Meraki is what Meraki is, but it would be very difficult to say that Meraki is an SD-WAN product when you compare it to something like a Telari or a Silverpeak or a CloudGenix. They have way more capabilities, in my view.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, you'll pretty quickly understand the differences if you start comparing those solutions, I would think. And if you can't, then just go and buy Meraki because you'll never understand the difference.
And we've got a link to all the new products if you want to go check it out. Let's move on. Juniper Networks, they are partnering with WLAN vendor Mist Systems to integrate Mist's wireless APs and Juniper Contrail SD-WAN. If you haven't heard of Mist, they make a big deal about their artificial intelligence and machine learning to sort of do automated remediation of your wireless LAN environment. Now they're hooking up with Juniper.
Yeah, Mist is quite interesting. They emphasize their artificial intelligence. They're like a cloud controller, and they pull data from the access points and the switches to do a whole bunch of edge stuff. The challenge here is Juniper's got its own wireless LAN product line. Didn't they do a partnership recently with Mojo or bought somebody?
It was Arista that bought Mojo. Juniper doesn't have their own product. Juniper, Juniper sort of inked up a reseller agreement with Aerohive Networks. They've been a longtime partner. Juniper's stance to date has been our wireless LAN strategy is to partner with everyone. So either they're adding Mist to the list maybe doing a try before you buy, possibly.
Now I remember. They originally were going into the market and saying, go and buy your own access points and we'll give you the operating system. And then now they sell their own hardware. So it looks like Juniper's getting some wireless. You know what this sounds like to me mostly? This sounds to me like a major customer went to Juniper and said, we need to do a deal. We need to do end-to-end. Mm-hmm. And we like this Mist product. Why don't you get together and do a partnership? And lo and behold, there's a partnership. That's just outright speculation and you know, rumor and innuendo, just to be clear. But I would bet that something like that has happened.
Right. And I should note that just a few weeks ago, or early August, Mist announced a partnership with VMware to interoperate with VeloCloud. So Mist is also locking up partnerships here and there.
Yeah, because they've got that cloud controller, they can federate their controller with what VeloCloud's doing. And, you know, same thing with Mist. They talk about their integration with Contrail. And we know that Juniper's pushing into the campus. So Mist is willing to link up the wireless and the wired. It's an edge technology. And in theory, VeloCloud needs a branch networking strategy.
Right.
So, you know, it's not enough to just do the WAN when, you know, Cisco will obviously be putting Viptela into the edge router, but already in that router will be a branch capability. And you know, Cisco also has the security technology behind that. They have the Telos threat intelligence. They have the proxy servers, the mail gateways, the breakout. So you'd send your traffic into the Viptela. And you know, some companies are partnering with Zscaler for that. So I think VeloCloud does need to accelerate some of its partnerships and or make acquisitions here in the branch, because customers buy branch networks for hardware, because you have to put hardware in the branch. And it may be that VMware has to dip its toes into hardware solutions for the branch if they want to win that business, because they may be disrupted by other players who are doing branch in a box. So be interesting to see how that evolves. You know, this is the SD-WAN space is very evolving very quickly. You know, there is a technology just router replacement and then move to SD-WAN. But a lot of customers are using this opportunity to say, well, it's not enough just to replace the router. We can value add by giving you a whole new branch capability, and instead of, you know, trunking the and so on and so on. So, yeah.
Yeah, and I kind of wonder if both Juniper and VMware, VMware certainly moving into the networking space, may be considering a WLAN solution down the line. Juniper, I feel like their portfolio, by not owning their own integrated WLAN product, kind of has a bit of a gap in its portfolio. And so wondering if there's some dating going on here before a potential marriage.
It's possible. You don't really know what the financials. A lot of that sort of stuff is driven by financials. How much money does it have, the cash to buy the company? Does the the startup you're partnering with want to be bought. You know, do they want to sell out and so forth?
Yep.
That's what makes me say it. This sounds more like a customer led thing.
Could be.
Customer did it, you know, said, I want a thing, put together this and this, and you can sell it to me. And they went, you know, we'll turn this into a whole, a corporate initiative. Because, you know, the deal must be fairly big if that for that to hold true, you know, like I said.
Right. And there's actually on the Juniper side, not a lot of detail about the actual integration. There's almost nothing in the press release. And then they have a link to a 4-page solutions white paper, which also has a surprisingly little information about the actual details on the integration. So it's more about, hey, do you like this idea? Contact sales.
Yeah. This is what makes me think it's a customer-led initiative, or, you know, or it's driven by something coming in from the market rather than an internal, you know, rather than some sort of strategic movement. This looks like a, yeah, if it was much more committed, if it was much deeper, there'd be signs of it in the announcements. And if it was exploratory, it'd say like, we're exploring a partnership rather than we've got a total partnership, Contrail's integrated, we're doing Edge. And then it just sort of waffles off into the end of it. I would expect something a little more. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, we'll keep an eye on it, see what turns out. In other Juniper news, the company has announced an extended partnership with Ericsson. They're going to deliver 5G solutions that bundle Juniper routers with Ericsson radio access hardware, and the joint packages are going to be managed and orchestrated by Ericsson software.
So Juniper's back in love with Ericsson, and Ericsson's back in love with Juniper. And probably the most significant thing about this is, where's Cisco?
That's a good question.
Do you remember in 2016, Cisco and Ericsson promised that they would do $1 billion worth of a business each, and by early 2017... they were already saying the deal was over. And I think I speculated at the time that Cisco would have seen this as a massive opportunity to go and tromp around Ericsson's customers and steal them away. And I'll bet that's what happened. I'd be pretty confident that Cisco went in and started to steal Ericsson's customers, and Ericsson shut them down and gone back to its original partnerships where it's the lead player and Juniper is very much going to be subsidiary to this. Juniper gets to sell its existing products, the MX series routers, PTX series transport routers for IPMPLS/optical, it gets to sell some DWDM interfaces. And of course, Ericsson's got its own optical relationships, its own capabilities. So this much more natural partnership, in my view, than it was with Cisco. And I suspect that Ericsson rues the day that it partnered with Cisco, because I don't think the Cisco salespeople could even help themselves. Even if they said they wouldn't, they probably just couldn't help themselves.
Reminded of that story of the frog and the scorpion crossing the river.
Yeah, I do think so. But the deal went sour almost immediately. It took 6 months or so for, you know, there was a couple of polite press releases, and then the rumors started to come around. If you do a search on Cisco Ericsson partnership, SDX Central in particular has been following it and sort of saying, you know, it's going badly. But then again, Chuck Robbins did stand up at Cisco Live this year and say the partnership's going, you know, we're renewing the partnership, which sort of suggests that things haven't gone so well. So you read into that what you will. We are performing tassiography here in its finest form.
What is tassiography?
Reading the tea leaves.
It's the official
term for reading tea leaves or coffee grounds in the bottom of your cup of coffee.
I see. My preferred divination system is goat entrails, but tassiography is probably a lot cleaner.
Tea leaves is so much more convenient, really. You can do it almost anywhere. Goat entrails requires, like, you know, it's messy.
It is a lot of work, but, you know, we're willing to put in the time for our audience.
Yes, so I do think that, you know, the Juniper partnership is very natural. It does make more sense. I'm not 100% sure why Ericsson thought turning away from its existing partnerships with, you know, Juniper, where they already deep sixed their their own routers. So they need somebody's routers to complete their 5G portfolio. Juniper makes perfect sense. And I imagine that Juniper will be quite pleased to see that revenue come back onto their books.
For sure. All right, a quick note to tell you about our new membership site, Ignition. You can find it at ignition.packetpushers.net. We've got free and paid membership tiers, and it's our site for content meant to drive your professional development.
Yeah, so really the free tier, the whole point of the membership system in the early phases is going to be producing content for you that we can organize. Sometimes when you throw stuff up on a website, it gets very disorganized and whatever. So putting it in a membership system allows us to classify it and put it into portfolios and groups and lessons and things like that. We don't have a lot of content up there now. I've got my career earbook there. Ethan's got his course of Quas Fundamentals. He recently was working on a book and was published, and he took some of the research that he did for that and turned it into a training course on Quas Fundamentals. You'll get access to that. But really, if you sign up for the paid membership today, you're just supporting the Packet Pushers. If you've gotten something out of the last 10 years of listening to the Packet Pushers, sign up for the membership. You're giving us $100 to say, well, thanks. And we are working really hard to try and get more content into there that's just for you. It may take us a while. We are struggling to keep up with the Packet Pushers production schedule and produce more content for you. And we have plans to bring on other people to make content. But yeah, that's the idea behind Ignition. It's a membership system where we'll be able to bring you more unique content. But in the meantime, you can just support us by getting over there, signing up for a paid membership, and thanks very much for being with us.
Yeah, so go check out ignition.packetpushers.net. Take a look, tell us what you think. And by the way, speaking of more content, you can check out our Packet Pushers channel on YouTube. We ran around VMworld shooting 2-3 minute interviews with interesting vendors and just smart people we happen to bump into on the show floor, where Greg and Ethan are rapidly editing those videos and posting them up. So if you want to see what Packet Pushers on video is like, head over to YouTube and search for Packet Pushers and watch some videos.
Yeah, we're still playing with the idea of YouTube. What does video look like in the era of, you know, we've been doing audio and writing for years, obviously. But we're wondering if video's got some things. So we're experimenting with the YouTube platform. Send us some feedback. If you like the 2 or 3, you know, we called it On the Spot, where we literally talk to people on the spot at VMware.
That's right. They had no idea we were coming. So it's kind of a little ambush.
I will be returning to my longer form stuff as and when, as time permits.
That's right. All right, back to the news. Fortinet, they've announced FortiNAC. This is a network access control product focused on IoT. FortiNAC is actually a rebranding of an existing product from Bradford Networks, which Fortinet acquired in June 2018.
So as I said at the time, I think one of the big things that I said at the beginning of this year was that identity and access control are going to be big topics through 2018. So far, score one for me. Ding. So we've seen Cisco with buy Duo Security. And, you know, obviously Fortinet buying Bradford. People who know Bradford know Bradford. Those of you who don't, don't. It's one of those products been around for so long. Most people have sort of forgotten it exists.
It's been around since 2000, yeah.
Yeah, that's right. Exactly. I wonder how many name changes. Has it never been through a name change?
That I don't know, but I do remember back in 2000, NAC was the hot topic. So they were there early.
Yeah, NAC's one of those things that's been in and out of fashion with enterprises. Right now, we're seeing a lot of focus on endpoint and endpoint controls and endpoint remediation. And NAC is a key part of that. How do you, you know, allow devices to access your network and how do you identify them?
And it's particularly coming back into flavor with the IoT. Yeah, and so Fortinet's playing here too now.
So this will be a play at trying to say IoT and access control. And I don't think Fortinet's going to be a winner here in the long run. That's not to say this solution doesn't work. And it may well work for some people, but really, you need, if you're going to have NAC, you need to be at the edge of the network. So at the branch, at the edge of the campus, on the wireless, you know, all those sorts of things. Doing it at the firewall sounds like, you know, where's this micro-segmentation? Where's the, how do I prevent lateral movement? If I have to wait until I hit the firewall or some sort of control point in the network, it's too late. You're not going to connect devices directly to a firewall to put access control in. So,
well, the way it works is that you run an appliance or a VM in your infrastructure, and this Bradford or Fortinet device goes out and uses APIs to query those devices, say, hey, what's on the network? Then does some fingerprinting and says, ah, this looks like an IoT device. Do you want to use your other switches, your firewalls, your APs or whatever to push it into a specific VLAN or do some other policy enforcement on it? Right now, the play to me seems more like visibility and understanding was actually on your network in regard to IoT, and then using other mechanisms to push policy and take care of it.
Yeah, that's a pretty blunt tool, right? We know that this is where Cisco's SD Access is pushing heavily, is that they can do application recognition right at the very edge of the network in the UADP2 chipset. And, you know, so yes, Fortinet has Wi-Fi controllers and some switches to do with Wi-Fi to build a campus edge. Mm-hmm. And, you know, perhaps the Bradford stuff does integrate with a wide range of third parties. But again, the application it recognition does, yeah. And if you're not doing it in the network, if you're doing it, say, by MAC address or, you know, you've got to have that high quality, high fidelity data source to do the application recognition or the device identification. And I'm not sure that doing it deeper into the network is the answer.
Well, if you're all in with Fortinet, they're positioning this very strongly as part of their Fortinet security fabric. So it seems like they're just filling out their portfolio in that regard as well.
Yeah. Well, Fortinet has a habit of picking up distressed assets and then bonding them into the bigger thing. So doing the supermarket model, you buy a company that's distressed, you put a new label on it, you tart up the product a little bit, and then you put it into your supermarket. And they've been doing that for, 10 or 15 years now. With the Fortinet firewall, they bought a bunch of hardware acceleration for that, you know, so on and so forth. So it's a good business model. It means that financially they're fairly strong. But, you know, now they've got wireless controllers, SIEMs, access points, 40 switch. I didn't really realize they actually had switches, but of course it'll be a white box OEM, I imagine, with an operating system. They've already got an operating system in the firewall. Wouldn't take much to add a bit to it.
Yep.
but I don't know if people would turn to Fortinet for their campus wireless and branch networking.
Right, that's always a question. But they're there if you want them.
They're there if they want them. So I think, you know, Fortinet would have to prove that. And then, as I said before, you know, you've got NAC. You've, all the elements are there, but where's the control? Where's the application recognition? Where's the, you know, Cisco's got a really strong story to tell here. I'm not seeing anything in this announcement that says we've got some super magic unicorn dust that nobody else has.
All right, well, we've got a link to the release if you want to go check it out and get more information. A little financial news, Nutanix, they posted their Q4 2018 financials. They earned revenues of just over $303 million for the quarter, but also posted a net loss for that same quarter of $87.4
million. Yeah, so still making a loss after all these years, not surprising. I think the thing that caught my eye here is that not so much that their share price dropped 3% because their forecast was bad, because when you actually dig into the numbers, it looks like their Q4, the one they've just reported on, absolutely blew the socks off, blew the wheels off the engine. They had a massive rise in software and support billings, like from 292 to 359 for the quarter. That's an astonishingly large rise. So maybe they did a couple of big deals that came in a bit earlier than they might have thought. And so they've actually got an empty pipeline for the next quarter, and that might be related to the drop. And of course, share prices value not only the intrinsic value of the company, but also some substantial part of the share price is based on forward growth. So building in a value for the forward predictions of growth or revenue or profits. So I suspect that Nutanix is resetting. I like to see Nutanix as a bellwether for the hyperconverged market generally. And again, just astonishing growth. One interesting thing I noted was the fact that they're actually talking about having very little hardware sales in the future. Did you see that?
I did not see that. That's very interesting, because their whole thing was our smart software with hardware combined is going to be your value proposition.
That's right. Well, the idea was that they were, you know, back in 2017, 25% of the revenue came from selling hardware, and now they're doing a straight pass-through with Dell, I believe.
Okay.
And their hardware sales is going to drop to 5 to 6%, and that's just going to be a, what they call it, pass-through. So basically, it's their commission on selling Dell hardware. Dell must give them a kickback on any sales that go through the Nutanix channel, and it's going to amount to 5% of their revenue, which is, you know, $20 or $30 million a year. Not a bad little kickback.
Not bad.
Yeah. So Dell gets to sell all the hardware, do all the support. Nutanix Gus gets to do software. So that suits them. That's what they've always wanted to be. I don't think they ever truly – I think we actually said this on the network break at the time. Nutanix selling hardware is because they must, not because they want to, because it takes a lot of cash to move hardware from left to right. And they'll be happy just to sell software and not have to worry about the hardware side. And, of course, Dell is completely geared up for the hardware. So it makes sense for them to do it too.
Absolutely. All right, this is our last sip. We're talking about a British Airways breach. Attackers have stolen information from as many as 380,000 customers of British Airways. The airline reported the breach last week and say intruders made off with credit card information and personal details of hundreds of thousands of customers. The attack affected customers who use BA's website and mobile app between August 21st and September 5th. So if you may fall into that timeline, you might want to go talk to your credit card provider.
Oh, look, insecurity. After all these years of insecurity, we're still insecure. Guess
yes,
what?
That's right.
Color me surprised.
That's right. British Airways also says it's very sorry, which, you know, if that makes you feel better, there you go.
Yeah, I can't even load their webpage through my ad blockers. Can you, that, what does that tell you? My ad blockers just completely throw it out of whack. Yeah. So, yeah, when you've got all that sort of third-party stuff on your website, that tends to be like a hint that you've stuffed it up. Lots of stuff on their website, but the thing I liked most about this announcement was, and I quote, "No British Airways customer will be left out of pocket as a result of this criminal cyber attack on its website and the airline's mobile app. This airline has guaranteed that financial losses suffered will be reimbursed." Never heard that from Equifax, did we?
Never did.
Never did. So, hello, British government, job well done. US government, where are you? You know, if companies were held to this sort of accountability, there'd be a lot more focus put on security, I think.
Perhaps, yes. Perhaps. All right, well, that wraps up the news portion of the show. Please stay tuned for a Coffee Talk conversation with 128 Technology talking about session-based routing. That's coming right up. Welcome to Coffee Talk from the Packet Pushers, a short, sharp, sponsored conversation to get you up to speed on the latest ideas in networking. Our sponsor today is 128 Technology, and we're going to talk about the 128 Technology's use of session-centric routing to optimize the network to deliver key business services. Our guest is Eric Thoen. He's VP of Product Management. Eric, welcome to the show. And to get us started, give us the elevator pitch for 128 Technology.
So 128 Technology, our tagline is, we make the network do what your business needs. And why that's, while that's very high level, it actually applies to many different businesses beyond simply an SD-WAN use case. It applies to a lot of different verticals, and we found a lot of traction in some interesting areas that make for fantastic use cases to discuss with all sorts of audiences.
So how does that... So let's try and turn that into something like traditional routing is where we send a packet out across the network. And you're saying it's kind of service oriented or service oriented?
Yes. One of the things that we do, we refer to the router that we build as the session smart router. We focus on the sessions, which are the way that you connect, a client connects to the services that exist in the network. And the data model that we create within our router is focused on those services, those applications, and those applications are what businesses really are trying to deliver, the IT department's trying to deliver to their business.
All right. So what makes this different from traditional hop-by-hop routing protocols, say like BGP or OSPF? Like, you know, OSPF builds a state database and then all we do is send select which interface to send it out of, or BGP, we take whatever the neighbor gives us and just sort of trust it. They're not very good protocols. They were invented in the 1970s, deployed in the 1980s, and now it's 2000, we're approaching 2020. It's 40-year-old technology. I mean, surely we can do better.
Oh, we're completely with you. I mean, I think changing the way we think about routing and the way that we do these things is exactly why we're here. We're a startup. We're trying to introduce new technology, even at the lowest levels. We have the concept of secure vector routing, where instead of using IPsec to connect between different points in the network securely, we use what we call secure vector routing, which employs metadata and then can also encrypt the packets that go, but it doesn't set up a static tunnel. It's actually dynamically being created on a session-by-session basis. So when a laptop or a user of some sort initiates a session with a remote server, we will be peering across the various intermediate networks, mm-hmm. which you were suggesting might be doing BGP or OSPF or what have mm-hmm. you, understanding all the different paths that exist in the network, then start to monitor those paths and be able to choose on an application basis, on a service basis, which of those paths makes the most sense. And what that really winds up being for a business is improving the quality of the applications that matter to that business. So, right. you know, if it's voice, you can make sure voice meets a certain SLA. If it's a data backup that's less important to you, you could choose a lower cost path, not necessarily in terms of hops, but in terms of whatever quality metrics you care about for that application.
So explain to me how that's done, because normally you could only in a routing protocol select one best path, and it's usually on some mm-hmm. arbitrary metric that's close to random as you can get, right? So how is it that you're suddenly able to deterministically select the lowest latency path or a specific path?
That's right. So within our router, what we create are what we call waypoints, which are basically NATed interfaces at the edges of networks. And so we identify, you know, we bookend a network with two of our routers, and those waypoints identify the interfaces that those routers speak to the network on. Across those interfaces, we start to identify all the paths to different applications. And then on those paths, we will start sending a modified BFD type packet to be able to monitor the quality of those different paths. Mm-hmm. Then as a new session starts from an endpoint, and we classify it in terms of policy as to, you know, it's a voice application, let's say, and it has a certain SLA with regard to latency, we look at the available paths and figure out which of those paths best meet that SLA. If it's voice, it might require low latency. If it's, a backup application, it might require just a minimal requirement, and it could be high latency. So we might choose a different path for that going to a different location. But it's the fact that first you recognize those paths and then you monitor those paths that gives you the information to be able to decide how to choose the appropriate one.
And so you're going to send that session down the same path. You're essentially picking a path through the network saying that's the path for this session. All the packets for that session are going to travel that path.
Well, there are a bunch of add-on features beyond that. That's the starting point when you first do the session. I think one of the things that we've found, especially when you get to more challenging use cases, and these are some of the industrial ones especially, or the remote operations use cases, where the quality of paths varies a lot, we will do a variety of different things to try and improve it. So if there's only one path, we'll do things which we refer to as session remediation, which are not unlike FEC, packet duplication, things like this where you're sending more information to be able to overcome impairments to the path. We do session migration, where if you have multiple paths, the one that was the good one goes down, or say the latency goes up, we can move that session seamlessly to a different path. And one of the important things that we do with our waypoints when we do a move like that is we're NATing at the two sides of the network, which means that end to end, that application and client see the same thing. So they never noticed that in between we might have moved the session to preserve the quality end to end. And then finally, the other one that we sort of do related to this is what we call session optimization, where especially with TCP, as I'm sure you're aware, on certain paths, if you have high latency, the protocol doesn't behave very well. So being able to optimize for that protocol can make a difference too. So on top of that initial multipath routing decision, there are a number of enhancements that you do that become very valuable for use cases where you have challenging connectivity.
So one of the things that we're seeing in the industry, the old fashion at the moment, you know, the hot fashion in the industry is this micro-segmentation idea that even inside of an ordinary corporation, you might be one company, but you actually have multiple tenants, different security levels are applied to them. And you have a solution for that. Now, tell me how that works in your case.
Yeah, used exactly the right language, and the language of our data model is identically tenants and services. So services are the applications, the servers that are delivering your services for your business. The tenants are the way in which we segment that network. And those tenants in our network can be hierarchical. So you might have engineering, and under engineering, you have, you know, test and coding or something like that. And they can have different attributes. They can inherit attributes, but you can set policies across your entire network, because this is a global data model, that allows you to define who that tenant is and what access they have. So the test organization engineering might have access to a Jenkins service of some sort. The coding organization might have access to Bitbucket, and the two maybe don't have access to the finance server that's another tenant within that organization. You can effectuate policy very easily with this, and you can audit policies very easily. And that's very important as we engage with our customers, because oftentimes what happens is their breaches happen because someone's getting access to the wrong server. If you have a global, a single point where you can audit and set these policies consistently across your entire network, that's actually very powerful from a management perspective.
It is, but how do you do that? Like, most of the time we do that with MPLS and we use access control lists and we say, if you match this ACL, then you belong with this MPLS tag, away you go, right? And that's a pretty rudimentary. I call it the loincloth of multi-segmentation, if you belong.
Okay. Right?
How do you do it in your case? You're doing it quite differently.
I'm trying to think if I have an equivalent analogy, but that's quite interesting.
We want to just avoid that analogy for the rest of the discussion.
On the edge of the network where we have the router, we are deny by default. So what happens is when you effectuate policy, when you set a policy within our data model, as a session starts, it has to match. Okay. And we match to a tenant. And the way in which we would match to a tenant is in a number of different ways. So on those edge routers, and depending on which edge router you are, you might match based on a VLAN. So for instance, we have a guest Wi-Fi and a primary Wi-Fi. They're on different VLANs. So on that router, we map the guest VLAN into one tenant, a guest tenant or something like that, and the other VLAN into an internal tenant. And then we can either further subsegment beyond that. There's another VLAN that's related to the engineering lab that has access to different services. But we're not limited to that. We can also do network interfaces, device interfaces, IP subnets, and they can vary based on whichever router it is in your network. So if you have 100 routers at one site, it might be based on VLANs. At the next site, it might be based on an IP address range. At a third site, it might be a physical interface. So you can map that tenancy into a variety of standard networking constructs, because realistically, you have to be inserted into a network that already exists in most cases. And so people typically have used something else to sort of segment their network in some way. So we have to transparently interface to that and map it into our data model structure.
And see, the way that you talk about your waypoint setting, which is sort of like segment routing or policy-based routing in a way, except it's not hop-by-hop policy-based routing, it's end-to-end. That also means that the data that flows inside of those micro-segments is actually symmetrical. The path that it flows outbound, it'll also flow backbound, right?
That's correct. So we always have this concept of a session, which includes flows in two directions, a flow going from the client, response from the server to the client. Together, we define those as a session and we keep track of them in that way. Because as you're suggesting, it's possible and it happens where a flow goes one way out and a different way on the way back. And to make sure that that application works in a consistent manner, you'd like them to make sure that they have the same SLA and policy related to it. So keeping track of sessions is really the language of these applications that are running on these servers. And that's why we believe it's important to be session-centric.
It is, because when you're doing voice over WAN, one of the biggest challenges is making, especially in complex WANs, is having the voice packets traverse the same path, because it causes deep damage to voice codecs when the different packets flow different paths and have different jitter and latency capabilities. So let's turn this around. So what 128 technology does, it has this secure vector routing protocol and the way that you use it. Let's talk about a use case where you've got a customer who's running remote operations. So let's say you've got an energy or a mining, and they've got all of these remote sites where the mining is happening or the energy is being created or transformers all around the country. How is it that your technology particularly brings value to this use case? Let's use that as an example.
That's a good one. So for instance, we have a customer right now that is an oil field services company. They have these remote oil rigs. They're actually land-based, not in the sea, but it could apply to the sea as well. And these land-based rigs go out in the middle of, you know, it's like Texas or somewhere like that, where there's no connectivity other than satellite, and maybe occasionally, depending on where you sit, there might be LTE. Okay, so you might have multiple paths, but both of those paths are probably pretty flaky. You're on the edge of that, you know, LTE RF radius. And with the satellite, if a rain cloud comes through, maybe that disrupts it. So the connectivity that you have in a lot of these remote cases is suspect at best. Mm. And the other thing is, it's often very, very expensive. So if you've ever gone out and bought satellite connectivity, it is not cheap. So there's a couple things
cheap,
that are
but it also changes over time. Like if the satellite moves around a bit, there's cloud cover.
Absolutely. And it's a shared medium. So it's more like your bunch of other people start talking. Suddenly you don't get as much bandwidth, you know, depending on the type of service.
Yeah, your bandwidth is temporal. I call that temporal bandwidth.
Temporal bandwidth changes. Exactly.
And it can also, litter, latency, all those things can change very rapidly over sub-second intervals even.
So there's a couple things that this particular customer really liked about our solution. One was, because a lot of it was satellite, was the session optimization that I was talking about. So, you know, building in optimization of TCP across a high latency link where you're talking about hundreds and hundreds of milliseconds, that makes a huge difference in terms of throughput performance. But that's not as unique as the way in which we do SVR. So in this particular case, in some of these satellite links, what was happening is, if the packets got big enough and started creating fragmentation, that would happen when you was using IPsec technology. So with IPsec, of course, you're going to encapsulate everything, you're going to send over this link. Well, the encapsulation takes about some amount of space related to each packet. And it happened that some of their applications were actually running right near that boundary. So when encapsulated IPsec, everything fragmented like crazy. One of the things that we do with our concept of SVR and metadata is we're stateful in terms of the router's end. So we signal in the first packet, and then after that, we basically substitute out the source and desk to be able to steer where that packet goes. What it means is you're not adding additional overhead. And so that overhead in this particular case was beneficial for two reasons. One was, it was just using less overhead, and it's a satellite and it's expensive. The second one, it was avoiding fragmentation, which was causing even more problems. So those are two examples that are very unique advantages that we have in an environment like that.
And your software is delivered, I mean, your product is delivered essentially as software, right? So I can run it on anything?
That's correct. So one of the things that we believe is important as a company today is to be entirely software-based and to abstract the underlying hardware. So really what we find is our customers deploy in a lot of different ways. You know, some people are on a white box that might have a hypervisor. Some people are in the cloud, whether it's AWS or Azure or wherever. Other people are on bare metal on a box that they're shipping to a remote site. One of the things that makes it easier to abstract is if you have a consistent way to manage all those things and to always present the same interface to those things, it makes it much easier to manage across these diverse deployments.
I'm curious, just thinking about a marketing approach, how are you guys positioning yourself? Right, because there's a lot of, you know, sort of SD-WAN-like capabilities that I would see here, but of course it's also routing, other security and policy and micro-segmentation. How are you guys positioning yourselves overall?
That's a good question, because one of the things that we have discovered is our approach is a lot more general than most of the other SD-WAN companies. So while we solve the SD-WAN use case per se, what we find is a lot of interest in a variety of other verticals and other use cases. And I actually find those ones a lot more interesting. So, you know, as we're talking about the mining one, you know, or the oil field one, or there was another one that we came across recently, which was a tree cutting application where there's this big truck that's out in the forest looking for for trees, and it has to have connectivity so it can find out how big the boards are so it picks the right tree to cut. It was like, they're just really cool, you know, but a lot of our competitors are not necessarily serving those markets. And that's actually one of the reasons that we've kind of become interested in what we generally are calling remote operations use cases or these digital transformation use cases, because they sort of work often in different verticals than the traditional SD-WAN, which tends to be very retail oriented. We'll do retail as well, but I think these other verticals tend to have problems that are of very high value to the business. You know, a lot of times what we find in the retail space is, you know, it's race to the bottom to some degree. When you wind up in some of these other verticals and are solving a real business problem for them, you know, your oil well out in the middle of nowhere, if you can provide continuous access to that, they may not have to send another person out to it. That is an enormous cost to them, you know, flying a person to the middle of nowhere. So if you
hard
solve
sell,
that problem,
hard value, to sell, but you know, getting people to believe that is difficult. But I agree with you in general. I think that software-based routing that you put onto an appropriate x86 appliance is broadly a better way to go than to be using custom hardware that might have, you know, special, you know, extensions or customizations from somebody, but I'm not sure that that's the right way to go long term.
All right. Well, we fit a lot in there, and I think there's probably more to be said. But Eric, thank you for coming on the show, and thanks 128 Technology for being a sponsor. If you want to find out more, just head over to www.128technology.com. You can get more information there. And of course, you can find this and many more fine free technical podcasts along with our community blog at packetpushers.net. You can follow us on Twitter at packetpushers, find us on LinkedIn, like us on Facebook, and rate us on iTunes. And last but not least, remember that too much networking would never be enough.